Welcome to this episode of SMP Stories. I'm your host, Director of Training, Ryan Coyman. And with me today is our guest, Mr. Larry Sills. Welcome to the show, Larry.
I'm glad to be here, Ryan.
Well, we're glad to have you here. And I think nobody can tell the SMP story probably better than you. You know, we've probably got 5,000 versions of it from every employee. But if I'm not mistaken, you're probably the longest tenured employee at this point now, right?
Not in history, but yes, today I am. I started in, it depends how you define, how you count. Some people say I started in 1939 when I was born, but full-time in since 1967.
Wow. Yeah, so
you've... A lot of numbers there.
Yeah. And you've seen a lot of changes in those years, not only within the industry, but technology and within the company as well, right?
Total in every area. One big change is when I started, we were all family companies on both the end, on the vendor side and the customer side. Basically all, there were some big guys, but basically all family companies, small. And it changed dramatically, obviously. Now you have these giant distributors and giant manufacturers.
Yeah,
but we're still family, and I think that's great, and that I think separates us from the pack.
Absolutely, and I think most of our listeners here would certainly agree with that. And, you know, from personal experience, the first sales meeting I went to in 2010 was in Nashville, and I will never forget you standing on the stage looking at Eric and saying, you know, don't forget each one of these people represents a family, and they're part of our family. And that speaks volumes to who you are and your philosophy with the company.
It's a big responsibility. I was taught to think of it that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're really responsible for all these people.
Yep, for
their
sure.
Families and their well-being, and we never forget that. Never.
Right. So tell us about growing up in the company, or, you know, seeing your dad and other family members in the business, and how this kind of shaped your role throughout the years.
Well, you know, I think they always try to teach me not how the products work, because they didn't know and I didn't know either, but the way to be. And it was always be moral, be straight, tell the truth, don't take any shortcuts, and that stuck with me. And I believe I have passed that on to Eric. And absolutely. I do think, again, that separates us from a lot of other companies who worry mostly about the next quarter. We worry about the next 100 years.
Correct.
And that's a different way to think. And I think it's the only way to think, really.
Absolutely. And you know, on behalf of us employees, I think we appreciate that and try and model that same behavior in our actions as well. So when you started with the company, what was your first role?
That's a long time ago. I think they couldn't think of what to do with me. So I started off doing sales administration, and one of my first jobs was to figure out the salesman's bonuses, which was a great exercise. And if you got it wrong, boy, you got a lot of people unhappy. So
sure.
I started with that. It was a good way to start, and got to know all the people and all that. It was a good start.
So what were some other roles as you evolved?
One thing that was very helpful was at that time we had made a decision, turned out to not be a particularly good decision. But they were concerned at the time that our whole business then was ignition points and condensers. That was 80% of our sales, those two little products. And the fear was they were going to become obsolete. And boy, we better think of something else to do. And so they came up with this idea that maybe we should become distributors. And we bought a bunch of jobbers and WDs. And I can tell you a lot of stories about that. But it was good for me. We weren't very successful in the business. We finally gave it up. mostly because we started to antagonize our customers as we were competing with them. So we got out of that. But I did learn an awful lot about the business from the customer's point of view, because we were one. We were a distributor. And I learned about their problems, and I think that was very helpful.
Absolutely. You know, I was having a conversation with one of my employees today and said, let's look at this from the customer point of view. And how does this work out for them? It's got to be equitable. So, So throughout the years with the company, I mean, yeah, that sounds like it's an impactful experience for you. And it also shows that S&P has been evolving for many years, right? I mean, you guys recognize that points and condensers weren't going to be around forever. And today when we start talking about electric vehicles and new
technology. We still sell some, you know, we still sell them.
We sell
a bunch. I haven't been on a car since 1960-something.
Somebody actually called me about a carburetor kit the other day, too. We still sell those. So what were some of your favorite roles in your time with the company?
Oh, my favorite was sales. I love that job. Again, these were, again, more family companies. I think Dale has it much harder than I did. Dale spends a lot of time negotiating price with big guys.
Yeah.
But I like them all. I mean, it's just different now.
Right. So when you went from sales, then did you come inside in LIC?
I guess they call it chief operating officer. It was just, we started dividing up the work between my father, my uncle, and myself. We were still a very small company. And my uncle, who was great with numbers, did like the finance and administration. My father didn't know how to make anything, but he loved the factory, so he got involved in that. And I still looked after sales and marketing. It worked out well. We had a good team.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm guessing with many family things, there's probably differences of opinions, but apparently you've overcome it.
They had a good rule. Obviously, they worked very well together. They're brothers-in-law. And they worked very well together. That doesn't always work out in family companies that you see and I've seen and we all see. They don't always work out. But this one worked out quite well. And they didn't agree on every topic. And they had, we were all in one building then. It was not like now where everything is in that 3718 building. And they had adjoining offices on the sixth floor. And when they didn't agree with something on something, they would close the door and open the door between them, but close the door to the outside. And everybody would know what was going on. And they would be there for a while, and then they'd walk out and they had it agreed. That was good to watch. So they had their things. It worked very well.
Absolutely. So what do you think their perspective would be if they came in today and saw this over $1 billion company? Really
incomprehensible.
Yeah.
Never could imagine. When they left, maybe, I don't remember, maybe we're doing about $1 million, $100 million. Yeah. Maybe we're doing about $100 million. They couldn't, you know, here we are all still out of one building in Long Island City.
Yep. Wow.
Now we're all over the place. And they couldn't grasp it. It's totally different.
Correct. Yeah.
I'm grasping it myself.
As do we all. All of a sudden, those numbers become quite big and influencing a lot of people. So, yep. In your mind, what was a key transition throughout the history of Standard Motor Products? That really set us up to where we are today. Or there's been numerous acquisitions, obviously, but
We got lucky. when we started, we were one of many, many what we called then ignition companies. And there were a dozen of them. We were all about the same size. We weren't bigger or small than anybody else. In fact, we had fewer of the bigger customers. But then these guys started making huge errors, and we picked up the pieces. So there was a company called P&D, which is actually around the corner then on Steinway Street, and our salesmen had funds with what the P&D meant, but it was really the names of the founder. And the and they made, they sold out to Bendix. That was the first mistake. And then Bendix decided to change their channel, the way they went to market. And that so antagonized all their customers that they left them. And then it became a big scramble to who would pick up the pieces. And I got involved in that scramble. That was a lot of fun, it was a lot of work. And I think we wound up with 80% of the business, of their business. So that we almost doubled our size overnight. And of course it was, we couldn't ship, we couldn't do anything. We ran out of invoices, paper, we ran out of everything. But that really was a big turning point. And a similar turning point, when Eklund, who then was our biggest competitor, sold to Dana, and they started performing poorly, and the customers gave up on them. And again, we were very successful. We picked up the pieces, and we wound up acquiring them. That doubled us again. So those were two, like, you know, quantum leaps that progressed us forward, mostly because our competitors messed up. But we were able to pick up the pieces and keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. So it sounds like kind of those family values and doing things right and taking care of customers set us up for when there's an opportunity like this, we were able to pick up the pieces, apply that, and move forward, right?
That's true. That's what we did.
Yeah, great. Yeah, and again, here we are, a global company with facilities in Germany, Poland, you know, throughout Asia, Central America, etc.
Amazing.
I've heard you tell the story before about Puerto Rico and a little bit, and what was kind of the experience there? And I think a key part in just illustrating who Standard Motor Products is as a humanitarian company came out of hurricane, right?
Yeah, that's a good one. We have some photos of the. I don't remember the year. All the years blend together to me now. But there was a big giant storm like we've been having recently called Hugo, Hurricane Hugo. It was in the 70s. It went right over the island. We had a big factory in Puerto Rico. That was our first big expansion. And the reason we did it, and many, many other manufacturers went to Puerto Rico then, because the government, and it was a smart idea, gave you a good tax break to go there. And they were trying to build up the economy. So many of us went. We went. Eklund was there. Lots of other companies there. So we were on the northeast corner of the island, a place called Fajardo. And we loved it there. I loved it. The people were great. We had a good time. We used to go there for Christmas just for fun. It was a nice place. And we liked the people very much. And it was a good operation. Anyway, this giant storm went right over the roof of our factory. And you'll see pictures of it. I think we have them in our book. It really destroyed it. And so it knocked us out for a couple of months before we could get back in business again. But it also devastated the people and where they lived and their houses and electricity and water. They didn't have anything. And the fellow who was in charge then was a guy named Dick Cannon from up here. Some may remember his name. And he was an ex-Marine. And he figured out, I don't know how he did it, but he chartered a plane. We loaded it up with the two things they needed. What do you need most? They needed water, they needed milk, and they needed generators so that they could get electricity going.
Yep.
We flew down. The first civilian plane was our plane, and gave it out. That was great. And then about a day later, I wanted to go down and see it myself and say hello to everybody. And Susan wanted to come. And so they were adamant. You can't bring your wife. It's terrible here. Awful. Don't bring her. The conditions are terrible. I brought her anyway. And it was terrific. We slept on the floor in the factory. And I think the people really appreciated the attention we gave. And we meant it from the heart. We felt good about doing it. It was a good moment. It was a good moment.
Absolutely. You know, and we still see some of that stuff carried out in a lot of other initiatives we do, whether it's assisting one of our own people or, you know, people on the other side of the world. So I think that's a great model or behavior that's been modeled for us here. You mentioned Susan. Tell us a little bit about Larry outside of work, just growing up, your youth, what neighborhood did you grow up, you know, and Susan is your wife, and a little bit about the family.
All right. I'm a New Yorker, born and bred, and still. I've been out of the country sometimes when I went, or out of New York when I was in high school and college and school after I was out of the city, but basically a New Yorker. I did have a 3-year experience in Africa, which I could tell you about if you want to hear.
That would be great. Yeah.
So I'm basically a New Yorker. I'm back here, and I'll come back to that. And fortunately, most of my kids are here, and my children are here, and I feel very contented. My Africa story, when I got out of school, I didn't want to come to Stanford right away. First of all, I thought I should try to prove myself in the real world, so I could do something besides work for the family. I also thought I wanted to go to a company that was bigger than us, and I could learn some of their techniques. And finally, I wanted to see the world a little bit. So I was a kid then. I was 25, and we were married, no kids. So I took a job with Pfizer. Nobody ever heard of them then. Now everybody's heard of them. I like to say I put them on the map. But anyway, and they were growing rapidly then because they had this product called terramycin, an antibiotic, and everybody wanted it, and their growth was huge. And so they were setting up businesses, little companies all over the world, and they needed to hire a bunch of people. So they hired me, amongst others. I went to work for them, and they said, okay, we're going to train you in New York. They had an office on 42nd Street, and we're going to train you for 6 months, and then we're going to send you to Paris. I said, oh, that sounds terrific. I went home and told my wife, told Susan, we're going to Paris. Oh, that was nice. So anyway, I did my 6 months. I passed whatever test they had, and it came time to go. And my boss brought me into his office, and he said, Bell Sills had a change in plans. We don't need you in Paris. We're going to send you to Africa. That's quite a change.
A little different.
At that point, Africa was in the news every day. There were riots and civil wars, kidnappings. So I went home and told Susan, we're going to Africa. She said, oh, that's great. And we wound up going there. We lived there for a little more than 2 years. It was a life-changing experience. And we still are connected with it in some ways. So that was my time out of the country. It was very, very thrilling.
What parts of Africa were you in then, primarily?
Well, I was in a lot of places. Pfizer's head office was in Kenya, Nairobi. And they said, that's the second best job I ever had. I was a trainee. You don't have to do anything. And I would go to, a little company in every country. So I would go to, I felt I'd won this prize. And they paid for Susan. And we went to every little country. We spent a month in a big fancy hotel they were paying for it. And my job was to write an article or write a report once a month. That was my job. But then I got to Ghana, which is on the west coast of Africa, a pretty small country, but a very nice country. And they said, okay, you got to stay here because we need you here. So I wound up living in Africa. We did for about 2 years. It was a very good thing. Then we came home.
And so then when you came home, is that when you rejoined the company? Or
I came home to work for Standard and also to have a kid. I had to figure out I have a kid born in America. So, that's when I went to work at Standard.
Awesome. Great story. Thanks for sharing that with us here. So you've got several brothers. I've met a couple of them, that are members on the board. Tell us about growing up with brothers, or do you have a sister or any other?
No, just brothers. We're all boys. I'm the oldest. My youngest is 7 years younger than me, and I think I didn't even meet him until I was 15. I was running around doing all different things. But we're good friends. We're one. Peter is my younger one. He's a lawyer, an environmental lawyer. Wrote a book about Agent Orange, which was very interesting. My middle brother was a teacher, and we're all in New York right now, and we see each other a lot, and it's very nice.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. And as a New Yorker, what's your favorite sports teams there?
All my teams rhyme with Ets. So you may see me, my Mets suspenders, which I wear to work. So the Mets, the Nets, the Jets. Are there any other? I root for them all. And they're all terrible, but I root for them all. I was a rabid Brooklyn Dodger fan.
Okay.
I can still give you the uniform number of everyone on the team in the 50s.
Wow.
And they broke my heart by moving away.
I was going to say, I'm sure that was a groundbreaking moment when they moved him out to LA. Yeah. Good memories. So you mentioned your brother's lawyer and author and teacher. If you didn't come to work for the company, what's something maybe you thought you would have done?
Oh, that's a very good question. I always loved journalism. And I was the editor of my high school paper. I was the editor of the college paper. And I really gave that serious thought. Semi-serious thought, because I was figuring one day I'll come to Stanford. But I just loved newspaper work. That was great. And one of the things that turned me against it was I was in college. I was the sports editor. So I went to Dartmouth. We had a football team and they had a stadium and there was a press box. So I got to go up in the press box and sit with all the professional sports writers, including the New York Times, which was always my idol. And so there I was in the same room as the guy writing the story for the New York Times.
Wow.
And there I am. I said, I'm going to learn everything. So I'm sitting up there watching the game and watching all these guys. They were drinking a lot, by the way.
also the inspiration.
I don't think they were even watching the game. Now, they worked on a deadline. I didn't have to write my story till Monday. And it's the Saturday afternoon. So they had to get this in right away. This is before computers. I guess they typed it and telexed it or something. Anyway, but they're sitting there with their portable typewriter and they're typing away. And I sort of snuck up to the New York Times guy. I'm standing behind him and he's writing this story, which got so convoluted. The Dartmouth, their nickname was the Indians and we were paying Penn and their nickname was the Quakers. And he got into this long, involved story about Indians and Quakers and on and on. It's about 4 or 5 paragraphs of that. Never even got to the game yet. So I'm reading over his shoulder. And he looks at me, he turns around, he looks at me and he says, "It's pretty terrible, isn't it?" I said, "He's the New York Times guy." And I say, "Oh, no, sir. I think it's terrific." And then he says, "Well, don't worry. They'll change it after I send it in." Next morning, I open the New York Times and I read his story. There's not one word that he wrote. It was completely rewritten in the office. So I said, this may not be such a great career after.
Right. And I think that still holds true today with a lot of journalism, as I've done a little bit of writing for some magazines and stuff myself. By the time it gets through the editors, it's unrecognizable as your own piece of work, right? No, that's a great story.
Some of you may read it. There was a big article about us in the Atlantic magazine a number of years ago.
Absolutely.
Written by a fellow named Adam Davidson. And in the course of being with this guy, we became friendly. He worked for several, but he worked for the Times. And he one day says, "How'd you like to visit the office?" I said, "Yeah, I'd like that. That'd be nice." He took me into the office. And we walked around and he introduced me to all the writers and some of the names I knew very well. And he always said the same thing. Every time he introduced me to somebody, he said, "Well, this is Larry Sills. His life's goal originally was to be a writer for the New York Times, but instead he went into the family business." Everyone said the same thing. He made the right decision. That was...
Oh, nice. Well, it's no surprise that you've maintained relationship with them as with most people you've run across. And I believe that article is called Making It in America, right?
I think that's right. Okay. That's a very good article.
Yeah, absolutely. I encourage any of our listeners, if they haven't seen it, to probably Google it and run across it. Tells tells more stories about who we are as a company here.
Yeah. Anybody wants, send me an email. I'll send it to you.
Even better. Yeah. So when you and Susan get some downtime, what are some hobbies or what do you guys do? I mean, you make it in the city much or what does life outside of work look like for you?
I used to travel a lot, different countries, but as we're getting older, it's harder to do that. So we're here more. But she's an artist. And as a result, we go to a lot of art museums. I know more about art than I really want to, but I do. And that's a bit. We go to theater a lot. We're real New Yorkers. We do New York stuff. And I still do a lot of exercise. You know, I used to run the marathon. I don't do that anymore, but I still walk a lot of miles a day with a group of people. A lot of that.
Awesome. Well, that's great. Now, as I say, I think you guys, as you mentioned, are true New Yorkers. A lot of opportunities to enjoy the arts there, and good to hear you're taking full advantage of it still.
Yeah.
So as we kind of wrap up our time here together, I mean, as you reflect on the past of the company and kind of envision it into the future, you know, what are some of your thoughts, you know, in the next 100 years, if you will?
Well, I'm very optimistic. I really am, with our people. And we've been very good at you know, bringing in new people, replacing older people, and just, it seems to me, seamlessly. And so, you know, at my level, I replaced my folks, and they replaced my grandfather. Eric has moved in to replace me. It's all going very smoothly, and I see that throughout the company. You know, new people coming in. I met three of our newer people, and I met them not at their desks, but outside the office or doing something else. And I spent a little bit of time with each of them, and I was so impressed with them, their enthusiasm, their skill. Energy. I was so impressed with them. I told that to Eric. I said, boy, I feel good about the future. We've got new people coming in. They're terrific. So whatever they change the car, however they change the distribution channels, and we've been through all that several times already, and it'll change again. I feel very optimistic about the future. Very much so.
We're really in the people business. We just sell car parts to help pay for it, right?
That's right. That's a good way to say it, Ryan.
So, again, what are some final thoughts here, you know, that you want to leave our listeners with? Or, you know, we appreciate the insights and the stories you've shared here. Just any final wrap-up thoughts?
You gave me a little wrap-up when we were talking before. And I used this one when we had the town meeting a couple of meetings ago. I got a sweatshirt from a very good friend and customer from Louisville, Kentucky, named Doug Washbish. And he gave me this sweatshirt, and it had a great slogan on it. And it, I thought, four words, work hard, be nice. And we tried that. That's us, man. That's us. Work hard, be nice. And I can expand it. Don't be a big shot. Be a regular person. Work hard, be nice. And folks, as long as we do that, we'll go another 100 years.
Well, there you have it, people. You've heard it from Mr. Sills himself. And so we're going to continue to work hard and be nice. And thanks again for your time and sharing some of your knowledge here with us.
It was a pleasure, Ryan. I enjoyed it. And I hope I didn't see everybody face to face, but one of the things I love doing is meeting everybody. So I hope to see you all face to face before too long.
Well, great. And thanks everybody for tuning in, and stay tuned. We'll be back with another great guest on SMP Stories.
SMP Stories.